Yeah, Methods Con. I presented a bit about reproducibility at the last Methods Con, and I think it was well received. And so I'm interested to talk at Methods Con again this year. And I'm presenting something about natural language processing, for example. And I really want to make it available to everyone in the audience exactly what I'm doing. So again, I'm going to be creating Jupyter notebooks that detail exactly what steps I've taken. So the people in the audience, if they're interested, they can follow right along and see what, oh, she scraped these files from that format and put it into a different format. Well, why do I do that? I want to make sure I write good notes in my code. And then she did this process instead of that one. Why? Because my research question uses this method instead of the other. By being really clear about all the steps that I'm taking and why I'm making those decisions, I'm hoping that it allows other people to see how the method applies to their research interests without just being confused by the terminology, which is very easy to do when people are talking about unfamiliar methods.
So can you tell us a bit about the Jupyter notebook and
Yeah,
how that works
Jupyter's.
and how that's so valuable to you?
Yeah, they're really useful. I find I store them in GitHub, which is a version-controlled sort of repository for projects. That means is it creates every time I make a change to that repository, it keeps the old version and the new version. So you can actually go back and look at old versions if you want. Now, one of the things that makes that quite useful is using Jupyter notebooks, which are interactive code pages that run in your browser. So they're a little bit easier for most people than installing separate software that you then have to run through a separate sort of interactive kind of software package. So if you've used R or Python, for example, you might have had to use an interpreter for one of those to make it run in your computer, and it's can be quite clunky. Jupyter Notebooks runs in your browser, so it's quite clean and tidy and easy to share. And you can also make them really interactive for other people, which means that they don't have to download the Python or R software that you had created it with. They can just run it in their browser, which is very handy if you're showing someone something that is very unfamiliar to them, that the steps to install and get the right version can be quite tedious. Although that's an important part of reproducibility, is being clear about what software and what software version you're using.
Going back to MethodsCon, and what else can people learn at the event to look forward to this year?
Oh, I had a look through and I thought there was something interesting going on in every session. If I remember, a lot of them were about choices people make in how they pair the research questions to the methods that they're trying to use. And I think that's a very interesting kind of focus. So it's explicitly saying this research question and this research method match up well because of A, B, and C. Instead of, I think, a more traditional way of learning a method might be you just get really detailed into the method and then assume that it applies to every research question you might come across. And I think it's a much more nuanced and subtle approach to pair it with a research question in that way.
Are there any other big events coming up over the next few months that relate to reproducibility?
Well, my team, the Computational Social Science team at UK Data Service, we are hoping to schedule, I think, a three-part session on machine learning that should be out in the autumn of this year. And I think that's an interesting one as well, because it's such a code-heavy topic. We'll be using GitHub repositories and Jupyter notebooks to teach people to give people access to the code we're using in those sessions. And I think it's a good way for people to play around with things that are otherwise maybe quite intimidating. So you don't have to install the software, you don't have to be excellent at it. You can just run the code that we've shown you and maybe play around with a couple of little things without any fear of breaking it or making it go squiffy.
And what further advice would you give to researchers looking to improve their practices in reproducibility?
I would say give yourself time to explore new tools and new processes. I think a lot of people feel really pressured to be churning out, like to be really productive and churn things out at the fastest rate they possibly can. But you will be more productive and a better researcher and probably a happier researcher in the long term if you give yourself time to reflect on your thinking and play around with, like, maybe this tool helps me capture ideas, you know, when I'm out and about, and that tool maybe captures ideas when I'm working at my desk, or this automation process makes it much easier to schedule things, and gosh, that saves me so much time, but it did take me an hour and a half to learn the scheduling. It's kind of being kind to yourself and letting yourself play around with your processes and tools, I think is really beneficial, and I worry that not enough people give themselves permission.
Anything else you'd like to say about reproducibility at all that we haven't covered?
Oh, well, I would say when the crisis of reproducibility was first noticed, when people noticed all of these big landmark studies that they couldn't replicate, they thought it was restricted to what are called the soft sciences, so things like psychology or sociology or things like that. But in fact, it's just as true in chemistry and physics and some other like hard sciences. So a lot of people's first reaction was to try and make soft sciences more like hard sciences, more quantitative, but that didn't really solve the problem. The problem is really just about clarity of ideas and communication, and it's not necessarily about what research you're actually doing. And I just want to let people be encouraged that no matter what you're doing, you can make it clearer. You can communicate your ideas very effectively. There's no reason you have to be worried that your field is particularly, at risk of reproducibility problems.
So if you've got good reproducibility and you can show evidence of it, it will help to strengthen the value of your research because it will show you the quality of the methods that you've applied to get to that point.
Absolutely. It allows people to trust your research much more. And it allows people to understand your research much more. And those are both important if you want to really have strong impact.
And so I know this goes back to some examples of at the highest level. Do you think at the highest level of research and policymaking, good reproducibility happens, or is there scope to improve it further, which through the UK Data Service, that kind of training support can help to make sure those improvements happen?
I think reproducibility is gaining traction at the highest levels, a big picture kind of topics, because you see more discussion about evidence-based policy. But there's always scope to make it better, because there's always a lot of decisions made for which the supporting data or the criteria for judgment or the process by how some decision was made are a bit hidden. Just sometimes it's inevitable, and sometimes it's right that they should be hidden. For example, if there's a risk of disclosure control, you absolutely can't just make the data available. But you could make a synthetic version of the data available so that everyone can see precisely what manipulations that data went through in order to reach the final sort of visualization or something like that. And that allows people to really trust and understand the processes much better, and therefore argue more coherently about whether to accept or reject some idea or policy.
So for example, you take the cost of living crisis, for example, there seems to be emerging different theories on how to address the problem. There are three different theories. If the ideas put forward could prove that they had good reproducibility techniques applied to them, that covers the evidence, do you think they could be valued to help persuade the public on the best policy to follow?
Absolutely. I think if everyone put forward a plan and it was clear what decisions their plan involved and what expected outcomes were likely from different measures and different interventions, then people would be much more likely to investigate the plans in detail. It's very hard to really accept or reject an idea that's vague, that doesn't give specifics, that doesn't draw on populations or use clear examples. But if, I think we've all experienced like a newspaper article where it says 27% of these people feel that way. And you're like, what people? What is the scale that they're being asked about? Like, what question did you ask them that you got this answer? And we react with a lot of distrust and doubt and maybe negativity and aggression sometimes, depending on what the article says. And I think that's true for policies and you know, ideas as well. Things like cost of living and crisis, it's really emotive and people are going to react very strongly. Give them the best information.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, so in a way, do you think in a way that, again, I guess if you had that kind of a reproducibility and evidence of methods behind the suggestions, then that would be an opportunity also for journalists to really scrutinise thoroughly the ideas for the benefit of the public, because it kind of be a kind of ricochet effect of people scrutinising the evidence, but then that evidence stacking up to really support the idea, which would then unite a consensus across different bodies and maybe different
political views. I would like to believe that people would scrutinise the claims and investigate them and really judge them on their merits. Not always convinced, though. I see a lot of newspaper articles, for example, about how the Bank of England is predicting inflation changes or something like that. Probably I could get access to the models that they used and the methods and the maybe even the data that they used to come to those recommendations or expectations. But I don't see them reported or linked to very often in the media. So there's definitely scope for more access to reproducibility in that kind of reporting.
So this reproducibility idea or concept, it seems to be underrated at the moment, the value of it. So there's scope for more appreciation of its value.
Well, I think a lot of people, they do value it, but they're still afraid of it, because when you make your processes clear and your decisions very transparent, there's more scope for criticism. There's more scope for people to say, oh, you didn't make that decision the way I would have. Or, you know, you didn't use the best data available. You just used the first data that you came across. And that can be very uncomfortable. I think a lot of researchers are used to it. But if you're in a more public setting, you know, making public policy decisions, maybe there's some motivation to not be as transparent as possible.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you much, Julia, for your time.
Absolutely. And
a lot there about reproducibility. I have to say I'm a big fan.
I've convinced one already.
Absolutely, yes. Good luck with your future boot camps and maybe you might talk about it.
Absolutely. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.